During the trip, interviews with the principals would tell them if the case was worth pursuing. One of the first witnesses contacted was Bill Brazel. What are you going to do on Friday night besides listen to this? He was reluctant to talk because of the number of people who had questioned him in the past. Meetings with Frank Joyce, the Proctors, and others were also arranged, names you'll remember from the previous reading in this book. Upon arriving in Albuquerque, Smith and Randall met with Mitchell. Mitchell had talked to Joyce, who had interviewed Mac Brazel before Brazel had surrendered his pieces of the craft to the Army and had then led the military to the crash site. Plans to meet with Joyce had to be postponed. Joyce was ill. And with the interview canceled, the only thing to do was to make the 200-mile trip from Albuquerque to the Roswell area. From there, they had to drive to Carrizozo to meet Bill Brazel. The first thing Bill Brazel said to them was, quote, "I've thought about this and thought about it, and I don't really know what I could tell you guys. My dad found this thing," he said, "and told me a little bit about it, not much, because the Air Force asked him to take an oath that he wouldn't tell anybody in detail about it, and my dad was such a guy that he went to his grave and he never told anybody. I found," Bill Brazel still talking, "a few bits and pieces later on. And the Air Force came out. They didn't confiscate it. They just put it to me in such a way that I should give it to them, or they would have. And I had no use for them. Dad had told me that he'd taken an oath that he wouldn't tell in detail anybody. He told me I didn't need to know, and probably I'm better off." Brazel talked about his father finding the material and what he did after he had made the discovery. Quote, "He went out there and he loaded it all up onto his truck. He took it into the headquarters of the ranch. He had a Jeep pickup, and it completely filled all that he could get on this Jeep pickup. And he picked it up and hauled it in. Now, he very likely did, though I don't know, when he got into headquarters, he might have took it all and pushed it under a shed. Very likely he did that to get it out of the pickup because he used his pickup. Later on, then, he went to Roswell. He didn't haul it down there because the Army or the Air Force came up and picked it up. They picked it up in a station wagon or a van and completely filled that, all they could carry. That was Major Marcel, and the CIC man," said Smith. "Yeah. Major Marcel, and I never met the man, but that name is, yeah, he's the man who talked to my dad." "How soon after the incident were you able to go to the ranch itself?" asked Smith. "I got up one morning and was living in Albuquerque at the time. I got the paper and I looked at it, and here's my dad's picture." Actually, the newspaper contained only a story about Mac Brazel and no picture. "I said to Shirley Brazel, 'What the hell did he do now?' So I proceeded out to the ranch. I think it was 2 or 3 days before my dad showed up, and I said, 'What'd you get into?' And he said, 'Oh, I found the thing out there.' The worldwide press was after him. I said, 'It looks like you're rich and famous, or famous anyway.' I said, 'I'll stay here and take care of the ranch,' but nothing happened, so I went back to Albuquerque to my own business. You asked me a question, and that's the first time I thought about it. I know he hauled it into the ranch, and we had some sheds there, and he backed the pickup to it and pushed all the stuff off it. We've heard that a number of neighbors were involved in some fashion," Randall said. "You're not aware of anyone like that at all?" Bill Brazel. "Probably he told them that he found a bunch of stuff. Now, Floyd Proctor might have come down. He might have. There might have been more than that who came out and looked at the stuff. And Dad just didn't say anything about it. By the time I talked to him, the Air Force or the Army had already had him, and he just wouldn't tell me very much about it. I'd ask him a question, and he told me a little about it, naturally, but if I asked me very many questions, he'd just say, well, I told them I wouldn't tell, and you don't need to know, that's the way he was. Schmidt, did your father seem different after he came home? No way. That he knew something that he still couldn't talk about? Said Schmidt, my dad knew a lot of things that he wouldn't talk about. He might know who stole the calf, but I don't know how to put it across to you people. He was an old-time Western cowboy. He didn't do a lot of talking. His philosophy in life was, if you can't say anything good about a person, don't say anything. It's been kind of hard for me to explain this to all the people who've called me about this thing. I say, one lady, a newspaper reporter from El Paso, and she said, you mean your own father didn't tell you, she said? Didn't you ask him? I said, yes, ma'am, I did ask him. But he had given his word to the Air Force that he wouldn't tell about it in detail, and I said, no, he didn't tell me. She said, I don't believe that. Then why'd you call me? I told her he took an oath not to tell, and he didn't. Did you find many pieces, Randall said? I imagine, not over a dozen, I'd say eight. Just different little pieces. There was only three items involved, something on the order of balsa wood, something on the order of heavy-gauge monofilament fishing line, a little piece of, wasn't really aluminum foil, it wasn't really lead foil, but it was on that order. One piece, about the size of my fingers, with jagged edges. After the Air Force came, did you ever go out there and look for anything else? Asked Schmidt. Oh, yes. Every time I was out there, I looked. Did you ever find anything? Nope. I never did find anything else. Riding horseback, you see four better than you can even walking. Walking, you got to watch where you put your feet. Riding a horse, you can really look. Well, naturally, I was curious. This thing made quite a track down through there. It took a year or two for it to grass back over and heal up. Then I rode up there probably on an average of once a week. When I was riding through that area, hell, I was looking. That's why I found these little pieces. I never really did go looking for anything. I didn't figure it was worth it anyway. But just curiosity. And I'd see something that didn't belong there, and I'd get off and stick it in my chap's pocket. I might keep it there for a week before I'd reach in there and see what it was. Did your father know you were collecting the pieces? Asked Schmidt. Oh, yeah. I showed it to him. He said, oh, yeah. That's some of the thing, that thing I found. But he didn't tell you to be quiet about it, said Schmidt. What the hell good is a little old scrap? A little piece of garbage. I was in Corona in the bar in the pool hall that was kind of a meeting place for that little town. That's where everybody got together when they went to town. Everybody was asking me. They'd all seen the papers, and they were all asking me about it. I said I'd picked up a few old bits and pieces and fragments. Well, what are they? I said, hell, I don't know. And lo and behold, here comes the military. In uniform? Asked Randall. Yep. I'm still not really sure, but I'm almost positive that the officer in charge, his name was Armstrong. A real nice guy. Now, he had a sergeant with him that was real nice. I think there were two other enlisted men. They came out to the ranch, and they were talking to me, and they said, we understand your father found this weather balloon. And I said, yeah. They said, we understand you found some bits and pieces of it. I've got a cigar box that's got a few in there. And this, I think, he was a captain, as best I can remember, said, well, we'd like to take it with us. I said, well. He smiled. He said, your father turned the rest of it over to us. You know, he's under an oath not to tell anyone. I said, who knows better than I do? Well, he said, we came after those bits and pieces. I kind of smiled, and I said, it's kind of like when I was in the Navy. We want volunteers. We want you, you and you. I said, okay, you can have the stuff. I have no use for it. He said, how well have you examined it? I said, well enough to know that I don't know what it is. He said, we'd rather that you wouldn't talk much about it. And I really didn't. After that, people would ask me, and I'd just say, well, did you ever see any of the neighbors out in the field? Asked Schmidt. Not anybody, said Brazell. As far as I know, the only people who have been out there and looked was the Army or the Air Force, whichever it was. I think they did come out there with quite a few troops. And they walked and really kind of combed the area. But as far as anyone else going out there, Floyd Proctor might have, but to my knowledge, he didn't find anything. Was your father the only one you ever showed the pieces you found? Said Smith. Yeah. He looked at it and said, yeah, that looks like some of the contraption I found. Actually, this was before monofilament fishing line was a popular item. That's the nearest I could compare it to. Now, there's this plastic fiber optics. It could have been that. But it was about like the heavy gauge nylon fishing line. That's the closest comparison as I can give you. And there were some pieces of wood. I had several of those. Real wood or like wood? Asked Smith. No, they were like wood. Well, they were like balsa wood, real light, kind of neutral color, kind of tan. I couldn't break it. Would it bend at all? Randall asked. Flex a little. Longest piece I found, about 6 inches, would flex a little. I couldn't break it, and I couldn't whittle it with my pocket knife. The only reason I noticed the tinfoil was that I picked this stuff up and put it in my chap's pocket. Like I said, I had it in there 2-3 days, and when I took it out and put it in the box, I happened to notice that when I put that piece of foil in the box, it started unfolding and flattened out. Then I got to playing with it. I would fold it or crease it and lay it down and watch it. It was kind of weird. Other than that, that's the three items I found. Piece of this balsa wood, some of that string, some of that foil. Were the edges straight? Asked Smith. No. The piece I found was a jagged piece. I couldn't tear it. Hell, tin foil or lead foil is easy, but I couldn't tear it. I didn't take pliers or anything. I just used my fingers. I didn't try to cut it with my knife, but I did try to whittle on that piece of wood. I didn't even get a little sliver off of it. Any color variations? The color was consistent throughout the pieces I found. It was a dull color. Want to hear any more?
Yes, sir.
Go on telephone. Well, Rancho Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Doc. You want a jumping horse show at our show? My barn is right across from yours, usually at the shows. And it ain't a real horse show if you don't show up. I remember that. You're fun to watch. You really got something to say. I'll see you at the next show. Barn across from yours. I'll look for you. Because we'll be there. North Hollywood, between the UFOs and the pyramids, do you have any opinion on Zachariah Sitkin's book? Yeah, I do. I think Zachariah Sitkin is the most well-informed researcher since Velikovsky. I don't agree with all of his conclusions. The evidence he offers for his conclusions, overwhelming. I can draw some different conclusions from the same evidence, but the evidence is overwhelming. And he may be right about that planet that you better look out for. I like Sitkin. I'm reading from UFO Crash at Roswell. Kevin Randall and Donald Smith. They're interviewing in 1988 the son of the farmer who found the crash site. The thing about the interview was Brazell had confirmed everything that Smith and Randall had ever heard about him or about him. From him or about him. There were a few minor discrepancies in his stories. Little changes that were explainable by the time between his telling of the stories. These little changes suggested a story told from a memory of the events rather than a rehearsed story told to convince the gullible that something untrue had happened. Smith, upon returning from New Mexico, briefed the CUFOS board in Chicago. Impressed with the preliminary report, Mark Rodiger, the scientific director, initiated plans for the first scientific excavation at the crash site since 1947. 10 months of research went into substantiating the actual crash site that included 2 trips into Corona, New Mexico. Meetings were arranged with scientists Carl B. Breck and Sue Ann Curtis, who worked for a major laboratory. Their effort would result in an expedition to New Mexico later, March 1989. Now we're getting closer to the present time. Both Smith and Randall realized shortly after the first trip to Roswell that there was much... Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Much more to do. One witness had provided, I bet this book's bought out wherever it's sold. One witness had provided a lead to the mortician who prepared the bodies of the aliens for shipment. Bill Brazel had told them a little about Tommy Tyree and the Proctors. They knew that Walter Haupt, the PIO at Roswell in the summer of 1947, the information officer who released the first news release that had to be corrected, still lived in Roswell, and they had not been able to talk to Frank Joyce. These were all things that had to be done. Because there was work to do in Albuquerque as well, Randall arrived a day early on the next trip. One thing to do was to check out the newspaper files. Copies were needed of all the articles that ran in both Albuquerque newspapers, and finding the picture of Mac Brazel in the paper would tell them exactly what day Bill Brazel had read about it, and that would give them a time frame for his return to the ranch. As already noted, they pulled the papers. There's no picture of Mac Brazel. There was an article. July 10th. Next, Randall tried to track down the mortician. He found the man identified as the mortician easily, but that was the last of the good luck. The man denied that it was him. He had never been a mortician, had never lived in Roswell. He'd been to Roswell on vacations, but that's the best he could do. Someone had given Smith and Randall bad information. The first day in Albuquerque had not worked out. No picture of Mac Brazel in the paper for Bill to see, as he had indicated. But there was an article for him to read. And then the man identified as the mortician had not been involved. That was the most disappointing. The next day, both Smith and Randall were ready to interview Frank Joyce. This time, he had agreed to meet with them. Randall took out a tape recorder and asked if Joyce minded if the session was recorded. "I would rather you didn't," he said. Randall turned off the recorder, and Smith asked, "Do you mind if we make notes?" "Nope." The first thing Joyce did was show them a number of documents, letters, and a teletype message to establish his credentials. He had been working at a radio station, KGFL in Roswell, in the summer of 1947. He also unfolded a sheet of teletype paper that had a question on it from the AP headquarters. On July 7, 1947, in response to the information coming out of Roswell, it asked, quote, "Is this the same ranch where there was a hullabaloo last week?" Joyce had no explanation for that comment. Joyce went on to explain that he would call the office of Sheriff George A. Wilcox in the afternoon to see if there was anything of interest happening. According to Joyce, Wilcox was unimpressed with the story that Brazel was telling, but handed the phone to Brazel, telling Joyce, "Here's something that you might find interesting." Joyce claimed that Wilcox didn't believe the story and Brazel wasn't sure what to do. Joyce suggested that he call the air base because the military was involved with all things flying and the officers might know what Brazel had found. Joyce said that Brazel had told him everything on the phone, but when asked for clarification, Joyce responded, "W.W. is dead, and I don't want to put words in a dead man's mouth." He refused to answer questions about what Brazel found, only that Brazel was in the sheriff's office, and it was Joyce's idea that Brazel call the military. The next day, according to Joyce, Walter Haupt, the PIO from the base, arrived at the station with a press release. According to Joyce, Haupt told me, "I'm giving you an hour on this." After Haupt left, Joyce took it, read it over, and then called Haupt right back. He said, "Walter, you don't want to send this out like this." According to Joyce, there were procedural errors in it. Haupt was making statements in the name of higher headquarters without permission to do it. Hout said that Colonel Blanchard had told him to release it. The release was issued, and Joyce claimed that a Colonel Johnson called him from the Pentagon screaming at him and demanding to know who the hell told him to issue the release. Joyce finally managed to convince Johnson that he was no longer in the Army, and there was nothing Johnson could do about it. Johnson responded, "I'll show you what I can do about it and what I can do to you." After he got the call, Joyce decided he better have some proof that he hadn't made up the story. He found the press release that Howard had given him. He showed it to the station owner, Walter Whitman Sr. According to Joyce, Brazell came to the radio station on July 9th. Brazell had a new story about his discovery that differed significantly from the one he had told before the military had interviewed him. According to Joyce, Brazell was under a great deal of stress and said it would go very hard on him if he didn't cooperate. During the second interview with Brazell, Joyce noticed there were several military officers waiting in the lobby of the station. They didn't say anything. They didn't accompany Brazell into the control room. As he was leaving, according to Joyce, Brazell turned and said, quote, "You know how they talk about little green men? Well, they weren't green." With that, Brazell, with the military officers surrounding him, left the station. After that was all over, Joyce claimed that someone came to the station and cleared out every scrap of paper that had anything about the event on it. They found everything, including those duplicates that Joyce had tried to hide. Joyce claimed that Judd Dixon, the AP man in Santa Fe, reported the same thing. Someone was pulling the paper trail apart. Dixon's files on the Roswell event had vanished. Smith and Randall quizzed Joyce for another 20 or 30 minutes, but were now covering the same ground. Joyce didn't remember anything new. They thanked him and all left the hotel room. Joyce drove back to work. Smith and Randall left for Capitan, New Mexico, where they would meet Bill Brazell. Brazell had promised to take them out to the crash site. On the way there, they learned little about the events of July 1947, but more about the Brazell family. Brazell now drove along county roads that were nothing more than plowed tracks through the ranges. Brazell said they periodically came out to plow the roads again, sometimes altering them, so that a road that led to one place 5 years earlier might no longer be there. Brazell turned off the road, used a smaller track across the prairie. There was a rutted road cut by the wheels of vehicles. It climbed a hill and disappeared. Now he drove cross country. There was no road to the crash site, just open ground where there were rattlesnakes, deer, sheep, and saddle. They came out of the side of the hill. In front of them was a shallow, narrow valley with a rounded, rocky area at one end. The other end opened gradually until it was nothing more than a pasture sloping down into another bigger valley. The gouge started up there and moved down in that direction, said Brazell. He described the gouge as running from the northwest to the southwest. It looked as if the thing had hit, bounced, scattering debris in the field. The gouge wasn't very deep, but it was about 10 feet wide in places. The whole thing was about 500 feet long. "Where'd you find the scraps?" asked Smith. Brazell pointed outside the truck and said, "Around here, all over here." But in March 1989, there was nothing to see. The gouge had grown over, according to Bill Brazell, within 2 years. The material, the lead foil, the balsa wood, or balsa-like wood, and the fiber optics had been cleaned by the military. There was nothing to mark the field as an extraordinary place. They returned to the pickup. Bill Brazell was sitting there waiting for them. "Nothing to see," he said. They returned to Capitan. That afternoon, they arranged to meet Walter Hout in Roswell. As the public information officer, he had been in a position to know a lot about what was happening on the base in July 1947. And it had been Hout who had issued the famous statement saying that officers at the Roswell Army Airfield had captured a flying saucer. They met Walter Hout at his home on Saturday afternoon. He invited them into his living room. He told them to go ahead and ask their questions. The first thing Walter said was that he could sum everything up that he knew in one word. Nothing. Randall started the official interview. You were, well, we all know you were the PIO out of Roswell when the thing came down. Yes. Blanchard said Jesse Marcel had brought something in that looked like a flying disc or a flying saucer or parts thereof. Hout said, put out a press release on this that it was discovered on a ranch outside of Roswell near Corona. Basically, that's all I'm going to tell you. Jesse's going to take it and fly it down to Fort Worth. So he was scheduled to go to Fort Worth, Randall asked. Hout. Marcel was going to put it in an aircraft and take it to Fort Worth. That's after they had looked at it and everything else. I didn't hear about it until I guess Jess was on his way to the flight line. That's about it. That's all I know. As I told you, I could tell you all this over the telephone. So Blanchard called you, Randall said. Told you we have one, put out your press release. You didn't ask him if you could see it. You just put out the press release. The next day the phone's been ringing off the hook and you said, wow, am I famous or what? I was famous enough that if you, this is all before your time. At one time they had clipping services that would send you a postcard that would say your name appeared in such and such paper, and if you send us 50 cents, a dollar, whatever it was, we'll send you a copy of the paper. I had two stacks of postcards that tall, and he indicated a stack about 6 inches high. From all over the world, I wasn't even smart enough to save the stamps. Did Jesse Marcel ever tell you anything about it? Schmidt asked. Nope. Did you ever see Mac Brazell? Nope. Did you ever discuss it with Frank Joyce? Nope. He called you after the press release before it went out over the wire and say you didn't want to say it that way? Randall asked. No. Advising you this was a mistake, said Schmidt? No. He hesitated and then said, I hate to be this way, but you're asking me pointed questions. Did you see Marcel after he came back from Fort Worth? Asked Schmidt. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you see him quite regularly. He lived right down the block here, one block. Right after he returned? No. I think the most interesting part of this whole thing, you can verify this by going down to the newspaper office and looking at the newspapers, is the time frame. For 2 days it was front page and then it disappeared. The thing died extremely fast. Especially after Fort Worth with Brigadier General Ramey, said Schmidt. Why do you think that Blanchard was so quick to order you to make the report? You'd have to have known the man. Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to phrase it. He had a very sincere interest in the relationship between the base and the community. If anything unusual or anything he felt the community should know about, he'd call me up and say, get this out. He did it with many things. If he thought of a thing like when you take releases into town, don't stop at the first one and give it to them every time. That was the morning dispatch on Main Street. And there was KGFL and KSWS and then the record. He wanted them alternated so that no one could say that we were showing partiality. But basically, I rarely questioned him on anything. Looking back on this from the perspective of 42 years, what do you think they found? Asked Randall. A bunch of stuff that Jess Marcel took to Fort Worth. I think actually they found something that they actually, and I've got to base what I'm saying, going to say on what Jess Marcel told me. It was something that he had never seen and didn't believe that it was of this planet. I trusted him on his knowledge. He felt that it was something that was not made or mined or built or manufactured anywhere on this planet. He was explaining things to me, a little thin, paper-thin piece of foil that you couldn't burn and you couldn't bend and you couldn't cut. He explained a whole bunch of this stuff to me. At the time, we thought, oh, Christ, weather balloon, that's good. Everybody accepted it as a weather balloon, said Schmidt. As a matter of fact, I guess it was a rumor they started about how dumb we were.
This is the end of Side 3.